Well, good evening. Welcome back to our sessions on this beautiful sunny evening. The people watching on television won't know any different. Delighted that we can be here tonight because in this third of our series, I think we've got a very interesting topic to look at and, of course, a very interesting panel. Perhaps a brief reminder of what the topic for tonight is. And as we are starting quite deliberately to get more practical in what we look at and less theoretical, we're asking about right and wrong, about making ethical decisions. And we're wondering whether a scientific approach can help us to distinguish what's right and wrong, what's better and worse, or is that actually that ethical question really something which people of faith are better equipped to help us pick our way through? So before we come to the discussion, could I just ask you all just very briefly to introduce yourselves and say who we have with us tonight?
I'm Dr. Mary Cooper.
That was brief enough, yes. Okay. She's absolutely right, yes.
Right, okay.
Mini Cooper.
My name is Michael Horner. I've been around here in Geneva for 30 plus years, but I was thrown out of the UK and came here for two, and my job was going to be long range planning, so that's the sort of accuracy I was given.
John.
I'm John Beach. I am the Episcopal priest at Emmanuel Church, and I've been here for 9 years.
I'm Wesley Ariyaraja. I'm originally from Sri Lanka, but I've been living here in Geneva since 1981. However, for the last 17 years, I was professor at the Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. So I'm one of those absentee members of the Scottish Presbyterian Church. But happily, I retired last December, and I've come back to permanently to be here. So I'm hoping that I'll be back in the church and I'll also get to know more of our congregation.
Thank you, Wesley. I was going to say that the Scottish Presbyterian Church has many absentee members. You just have a better excuse than most. So let's get to the topic of our discussion. And for those who may be here for the first time, the pattern is that we'll have some responses to initial questions from our panelists, and then we have the chance to break out into groups and to just share our responses to that and come up with our own input. Then we gather again to hear what's been talked about and have some conversation around that. So Mary, I believe you're going to tell us something about the work you've been doing at the World Health Organization, which I think will be helpful for us to understand this topic. And the question is, in a sense, about the scientific approach to problem solving and how you've seen that in your work.
Right. Well, the reason I was brief in my introduction was that I was going to tell you a little bit, yes, about what I've been doing since I retired about 5 years ago from the World Health Organization. Before that, I was working in the World Health Organization for about 25 years. And the first half of that time I was spent in maintaining the model list of essential medicines. That's an internationally recognized set of medicines to help countries choose their priority health needs. And also during that time, I was responsible for developing prescribing information on these medicines and a model formulary for them. The second half of my time in WHO, I was the manager of the program for the safety of medicines. That is to ensure that once a medicine is put on the market, it is safe to use. That was the International Program of Adverse Drug Reaction Monitoring. Now, the most significant advance that I've seen in both these areas has been the development of evidence-based medicine. This is a method which allows decisions on the treatment of patients to be driven by scientific methods. Before that time, the methodology was familiarly known as the Gobsat method. Good old boys sitting around a table. Now, basically, it was okay. There was nothing wrong with it because there would be clinicians with lots of experience in the subject. They would get together and they would make decisions based on their own experience. But evidence-based medicine, on the other hand, which was developed in 1980s, early 1990s. It is a methodology which systematically reviews, appraises, and uses clinical research findings to aid the optimal treatment of patients, optimal clinical care of patients. The methodology, as I said, it was developed in the States and by a collaboration of people in both the States and Canada. In 1992, the Cochrane Library was funded in the UK using this methodology. This became the Cochrane Centre, which rapidly grew and became an internationally recognised centre of excellence to prepare systematic reviews of randomised clinical trials of healthcare. Basically, what was done was all the randomised clinical trials are gathered in one huge searchable database known as the Cochrane Library. And an international network of researchers are involved in a rigorous process of systematic review and appraisal of these findings, and they make their findings available to the public in an easily accessible, meaningful fashion that allows clinical decisions to be taken. One example would be the use of heparin in thromboembolic disease. Now that is deep venous thrombosis, sometimes can go on to pulmonary embolism. But there are questions around the use of heparin. Although heparin is known to be the anticoagulant of choice, which is used in that disease, but which ones do you use? There's normal heparin, there's low molecular weight heparin, and there are questions surrounding their use and the best strategy for preventing DVTs in high-risk situations. What is the best treatment for established thromboembolic disease? And is the treatment best given in a hospital or a home environment? All these questions can be answered by a systematic review by a clinician working through a systematic review of the evidence that are published on the various reviews. And these results can then be published in evidence-based guidelines. So you now have evidence-based guidelines on anything from dengue fever to malaria to hypertension to what you name it. There is a guideline for it. And in the UK, the NICE guidelines have been developed. And there is a clinician in this room who knows far more about that than I do. So I'm not going to mention any more about them. But as I said, the database is very easy to use. And for the purpose of this evening, I did a search using the keyword prayer. What you do is you Google Cochrane Library's Cochrane Library database search, and there's a screen comes up, keywords there's a drop down menu for which title, abstract, review. Anyway, the keyword I typed in was prayer. And I found one intervention review entitled Intercessory Prayer for the Alleviation of Ill Health. Now, the authors had found 10 studies of this with a total of about 7,500 patients, which is not an enormous amount for clinical studies, but it's okay. Unsurprisingly, their conclusions were that there is not enough evidence to say whether prayer is any good or not, and it was stated perhaps that further studies should be undertaken. But I didn't find that interesting. What I found interesting was the very fact that people had thought they could use this method to prove the power of prayer, because I don't, in my opinion, I think measuring the impossible is just not is just not feasible. But anyway, to conclude, the the evidence-based medicine is a scientific method which does good in other aspects of medicine and has made huge improvements in the treatment of how to use medicines.
I think that's a great introduction to our whole topic, Mary, because in a sense what you describe is medicine that's very, very black and white, it's not a matter of opinion, you can measure, you can see what's most effective. Is that taking ethics out of the question altogether? Or, I mean, I understand that ethics is still a big issue within medicine. Where does that come into it?
Well, the ethical question in medicine is a huge subject, Ian. With the advantages in medical technology, there's hardly an area in medicine that doesn't have an ethical aspect. For example, the beginning of life. When does life begin? Is it ethical to terminate a pregnancy with a birth defect? And the end of life care. When is it ethical to switch off the life support if the patient's in a vegetative state? Is it ethical to switch off the life support? The use of embryos is a minefield at the moment. And the latest one, which has been in the news, has been mitochondrial disease. Yes, I see somebody nodding his head. Is it ethical to have three parents? Now, that's not the question. It's just the use of technology in that area to treat diseases. There are about 150 children born with mitochondrial disease every year. And is it ethical to use embryos healthy embryos to treat that disease? This had to be put to a parliamentary decision, which was really quite incredible. And then there's other questions such as personal information. Who has access to your records, and when is it ethical to see your records? Organ transplantation. Who gets the kidney? And should alcoholics be allowed liver transplants? Patient rights. Do you have the right to refuse treatment? If you're a Jehovah's Witness, you don't want to have blood. Is it ethical for you to refuse treatment for your child in that instance? There have been instances which have been had to go to court. And no one person can make these decisions. And that is why there has been a huge expansion in the use of ethics committees. And nowadays, in most developed countries, and most countries, in fact, in the world, that all hospitals should have their own ethical committee. These ethical committees are educational and advisory in purpose. Generally, the function is to assist people to come to a conclusion about an issue. The ethics committee should consist of mainly medical professionals, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and other healthcare providers. In addition, they may draw on lay people, clergy, and even lawyers to help them in the decisions they have to make. The recommendations of these committees the institution is not obliged to take the recommendations on board, but it does help in making the decision. So that is a brief introduction into the ethics of medicine at the moment.
So in a sense, the more we learn how to do effectively, the more questions come up
exactly.
for us.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I'm going to come to you, and you've suggested I introduce you as a general scientist. Would that do as a description? Moved through various kinds of scientific approach to life, and I want that general approach tonight, because what I want is, what evidence could you point to that science has been able to do good in the world?
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for the honour of speaking to this group, and also You are the second person who's called me a scientist, and I'll explain that as I go along. I'd like to, as it were, defend science maybe a bit more vigorously than I actually believe, because it's been given some bad rap recently. My story, in a way, begins when my mother and I were quickly moved to the innermost part of Sussex when World War II broke out, and we left in a hurry with me, my mother, and a bunch of books, including the Bible. And my mother, deeply religious, insisted on discussing with these biblical things. They seemed to all be Bibles around my cot and later on my bed and so on. And eventually, when I was responding back and understood at least the words, if not the meaning, we came to an agreement. I would go to church, I would go to Sunday school, I would pay attention, I would argue with her until she felt that my responses were as good as her own, at which point the Sunday school could go. And when it did, I was about 14, and I discovered bikes and girls. I was still obliged to go to church. My foolishness at that time was to admit or state to my mother that I thought I'd figured out how the world works. And she got me to explain, and it was just a very large, complicated bike mechanism. And she insisted the next time we went to church together that I should tell the vicar. Now, he wasn't English either, he was Welsh. So I'm being... So he said to me, so tell me, your mother tells me you've sorted it all out. So I explained this great mechanical system in the sky and so on. And he said, do you know, you're in good company. There was a famous scientist called Newton. This thing has a name. It's called the Newtonian model. And it's also got another name, which is called a cosmology. So in order to answer the question, I have to tell you a little bit about my current cosmology, which has moved on a bit from bikes, right? But not the girls part. The cosmology I have at the moment, and this is in a sense a working hypothesis, is that everything's alive. The notion of the planet Earth being Gaia is well understood. And I'd just like to go a little further and say, in order to study social systems, we can take an idea which I call living systems. Living systems theory, if you like. And to be clear, if we think of a butterfly system, it starts with a pupa, it goes to a caterpillar, then it comes a butterfly, something weird happens, and the system goes around about once a year. That's a living system, and it's called the butterfly system. So the idea of something abstract, the butterfly system, exists. In order to finally get to the question, I'd like to draw your attention to a system called capitalism, and I would recommend the work, as Newton did, that I've done, tried to stand on the shoulders of a giant who studied capitalism, and he argues that the cycle time of capitalism is not about a year, it's more like 54 years, and if you buy this, now it's getting a little difficult to buy all these things at once, earlier on, meaning hundreds of years ago, there was the French Revolution. In some 54-year cycle thing, where we are now can be judged. And earlier was a thing called religion. This is not to not religion at all, but it's to say that religion was the scheme which gave solace to people when they were worried about famine and bad things like pestilences and civil wars and so on. And this is, as you well know, in the part of Revelation 6, which I won't ask you to quote. Right. So in the analysis of my hero here, Immanuel Wallerstein, he says the four horsemen of the apocalypse were originally the basic needs being met by religion, and now we have capitalistic civilization, which I claim is basically completely underpinned by science. So now we have a method used by Mr. Wallerstein in his nice little book here, which is to use the metrics of pestilence and hunger applied individually. And he says, how about inoculation? We give that a plus. How about infant mortality? We give that a plus. Longer lives, we give that a plus. Mixing the gene pools, I'm not so sure. Now, individual hunger can be dealt with, the short-term weather, but two bad summers, two bad winters, and we're in trouble. Deforestation, definitely negative. Desertification, land pollution, air pollution. We know the story there. Now, I should recall that this analysis was done in 1983. So when I finish this, which won't be very long, we could now look a little further if we want to, because that was 30 years ago. So collective pestilence, we know about quarantine. We have the work of people like Mary Cooper. But travel, this has introduced new diseases, as has temperature change. At the time, AIDS was a big worry. This was 83. Collective hunger, food problems, productivity is going up, but genetic modification has now got a very bad, bad reputation. We've ruined the ozone layer, what will that do? So here are some like mixed messages when we look at science, does it or does it not do good? And now the rather more troublesome area, civil war and conquest or war between nations. Those of you of my age maybe remember Hiroshima and the dreaded things there, and Pandora's box is definitely open. If you say that nations are infatuated with economic wealth, yes, it's true, wealth has grown, but only 1/7 of the population is better off. The other 6/7 are, relatively speaking, worse off. And civil war, which seems to be an invention of the capitalist economy, it's been ethnicized. There's lots of struggles, lots of riots, lots of genocide. And if we go forward to today, definitely more civil wars rather than less. That was sort of quantitative stuff. And now on the qualitative side, the basic needs maybe have been met. But as people move out of Maslow's triangle towards the comfort zone, they love to go and tour. Unfortunately, tourism is very destructive globally. So if we summarize the quality of individual life, it's a mixed message. Collectively, well, democracy was supposed to, if you like, generate more wealth. It was supposed to trickle down. And there was a scheme of having one vote per person and so on and so on. And maybe that's worked. But on the whole, the defenders of capitalism don't like it completely, and those who are against capitalism have more or less the same negative feelings. There's alienation in both sides, and maybe one of the most important things now, not in 1983, there's a huge distinction between mental disease and other diseases, and we don't really know very much about that. To answer, before you ask it, the question on ethics, part of capitalism generates an idea of universalism. We say the law of conservation of energy, we say natural law for this, that and the other in the physics world. Now, I would argue that what we're trying to do with the more troublesome things like human rights is, as you pointed out, Ian, we're at the early stages, butterfly collection they call it, and eventually we will have laws which we can understand, which deal with the ethical issues. Another, that's another gift from science. I rest my case.
Fascinated by all that. So many questions come to mind. I don't want to anticipate too many of them because that may be your job. To the question, has science been able to do good in the world? You're saying the jury is still out.
Right.
Right. Thought that. Let me turn to my friends on the left. Perhaps we'll come to Wesley first, just because that's the order I've written your names down in. Wesley, you bring a great wealth of knowledge of not just the Christian faith, but beyond that, from your background in Sri Lanka, as well as your studies. Now, much has been written, perhaps increasingly, about the negative things which religion contributes to our world: wars, discrimination, division. Can you tell us something you have seen in terms of religion being an influence for good in the world?
Thank you. First of all, my apology that I had not been in the two previous sessions, so I'm somewhat freewheeling here without knowing exactly the... But I'm very happy to be here and to be participating in this one. I want to say, first of all, two things about the negative side of religion, which is being much discussed, and then go on to answer your question about...
No one answers my questions directly, yeah. So you're just fine.
Yeah. The problem why religion is so much bad press is that religion is an extremely complex phenomenon. There's a historical dimension to religion, a sociological dimension to religion, institutional dimensions to religion, there's a political dimension to religion. Then there are, of course, ethical, moral, spiritual dimensions of religion. Therefore, when we talk about religion, we cannot generally speak about religion as such, because religion is an extremely complex. Sociology of religion is very different from, because religion has a historical side. There have been historically relationships between religions, etc., that affects us. Therefore, there is no pure thing called religion. Religion itself is an extremely complex reality, and therefore to ask whether religion is good or bad is a wrong question, because religion itself cannot be narrowed down to what it is. But that's a big topic, so I don't go further on it. Secondly, religion, like science, can be used, misused, and abused. So it is in itself maybe something, but in the way it is being used, misused, and abused, religion has various manifestations. And some of the negative manifestations of religion, because of the way it is being misused or abused for various political, social, economic ends, etc., has also given enormous negative impact on what is religion, what religion is all about. Now, this is a very big topic about then what do we mean by religion, what is the essence of religion, etc., to which we don't have much time to go into. So I want to answer your question so directly on three ways in which a religion can be an influence for good. And first of all, I want to say, use the word accountability. Accountability. That is, by positing an understanding of God, or a universal dharma, or about universal principle that whether it exists or not, and whether it is a God or a etc., is a different question. But it enables human beings to be accountable to something other than themselves, or to what they think is good and bad. Now, some people may say it is oppressive and it is bad, etc. But accountability, if you look at our own faith, or about Hinduism, Buddhism, any of these religious traditions, what the religion does to human beings is to say that you are accountable. It's very interesting that in the opening chapters of Genesis, there are two basic questions that define human predicament. Adam, where are you? So you can act the way you like, but you are accountable to God. Or Cain kills Abel because he thought he can do what he likes. Then the question, Cain, where is your brother? The blood of your brother is calling from the ground. So that you just don't live for yourself, or decide for yourself entirely what is good and what is bad, or act in any way that you like, but you are accountable to something greater. That is a debatable thing, which is greater. But it is difficult for human life to be led in a much moral and ethical grounds without religion introducing a dimension of the transcendent or something other to which we humans individually and together are accountable. So that is the first good that religion brings to human life: accountability. Secondly, in spite of all the negative dimensions of religion, we can take several examples where religion has been the source of enormous spiritual strength and good well-being. I just take three familiar examples. And let us take Mahatma Gandhi, who was prepared to organize the whole country to struggle for religious freedom. For him, he said, with the New Testament in the one hand and the Bhagavad Gita on the other, Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount, that says, do not resist evil with evil, but overcome evil with good. Gandhi said, here is a principle that can work. Or in Bhagavad Gita, that you do what is right without attachment to whether it is good or bad or whether it is beneficial to you or not, without attachment to. Do something because it is the right thing to do. So that do your duty without being anxious about what impact it will have on you. Therefore, the religious inspiration that Gandhi got was able to inspire him to take on an empire on a spiritual basis. And if you ask Gandhi, he will say, it is the New Testament or the Sermon on the Mount and the Bhagavad Gita that gave him that strength. Or if you ask Martin Luther King Jr., he would say that his strength to organize a struggle against racism is from the gospel. It is not that he discussed some. He never gave up the reason that according to the gospel, we cannot be one cannot be superior and the other cannot be inferior. Therefore, he felt that the religion does. Or take Mother Teresa, another example, or somebody who does ministry to people who are never going to recover but are going to die, ministry to the dying. Where do they get the strength from? They are getting the strength from inner spiritual resources that have been provided by their religious tradition. And these are outstanding examples. In our own families, in our own ordinary people, it's the inspiration of their own faith when it's rightly understood that had been the source for living a life that is moral and ethical. I do not know whether it is possible without some such spiritual resources to be able for us to act in a different manner. And the third one is a much more public question. If you read the history of how the Judeo-Christian tradition had impacted the world, the idea of the equality of men and women or one human beings, the whole question of the human rights, the whole question of humanitarian aid, the struggle against racism, against caste, about untouchability, against oppression of women. All these things are coming from the ethical, moral principles that have been spelled out in the Judeo-Christian tradition. We have the international human rights, and we have all the other universal declarations. But those people who drew them, and if you read the history of the development of the human rights or the humanitarian, etc., they are drawing inspiration from their own spiritual resources from their life. Therefore, on the one hand, there is this negative side of religion because of institutional, political, sociological, historical dimensions. On the other hand, religion also can provide spiritual moral foundations for acting ways that can build human community and can bring about greater peace and harmony among us.
Can I just come back to you on that? In a sense, great examples of people who are doing good in the world, Martin Luther King, fighting for freedom, justice. Where do we get the sense that these are good things? That it's better to be just than to be discriminating. Is that a religious concept, or is that more universal than religion even?
Yeah, I think jury is out.
Right.
There is no decision whether there are some universal principles that are. I mean, Immanuel Kant's idea of the moral. Whether human beings by some nature are moral beings and that we know what we ought to do even though when we do wrong. Mm-hmm. And therefore you don't have to have an external reference you know, for that morality and ethical life is ingrained into human existence. But while like I have no trouble with that, because I don't think I have to say either side. But if you read the human history, I am not very sure that human beings have proved that they are in their own resources, moral, ethical beings, etc. History is written in blood. That is how our human history had been. And therefore, the uncritical belief that human beings can naturally be moral is a problem. And whether that means that we have to introduce God and God's Ten Commandments, things like that is a very different question. Mm-hmm. But I would say the jury is out on this question. We are not decided whether human beings on their own can find the basic principles that have to. Or a sociological scientist will say, human beings, in order to be able to live together, have developed social conventions and morals, etc. Even that, if you analyze it deeply, is not convincing for me. I come to the United States now, and we talk about the financial crisis and the greed, and they say the best president we can have is the best president that the money can buy. So, and there is no inbuilt system within the capitalist system or within the financial system or even within the people who are concerned about all this going wrong to be able to say this is wrong. There has to be a prophetic voice that has to come out from outside. So, let us talk about it when we come.
Yes, thank you. That's great.
It's a controversial question.
And we've heard this phrase, the jury's out, twice, which from both sides of me, which is interesting. John, my good friend, I'm going to ask you the most direct and difficult question of all, because I trust you. Can you explain to all of us how your church helps to make the world a better place? Or if you like, how does it help to make Geneva a better place?
And I think being in the concrete is much easier for me. Sometimes when I get into the abstract, I get lost in a swamp that I can never extricate myself from. And in fact, I think the concrete examples is ministry to those who are suffering in some way, either those who are suffering from poverty or disease, or who have had horrific events happen to them, or are stuck in their own bad place, and to proclaim to them that they are loved, and to say where possible and appropriate, to say to be an instrument of justice, to say you are not defined by the pain that you live every day. How do we speak love to those people who are suffering in some way? So in the specific ways we do that, we serve food to those who are hungry in our city. We raise money for relief and development projects around the world, and there is a good feeling of altruism from people who live in financially comfortable and economically stable circumstances to actually give of themselves to something beyond themselves is a very gratifying thing to do. So it's something that benefits everybody. That's one way, and that's the most tangible way. Something that is very powerful and real and not quite so quantifiable is giving a moral compass to those people who are in places where the moral compass is suspect. Those who work for UN agencies or other humanitarian agencies who are beholding to your funding agencies and to your stakeholders and sometimes have to become part of dysfunctional organizations. And some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, and some of you haven't a clue what I'm talking about. But if you're in a situation where you've entered into a work or an organization with lofty aspirations for how you could be an instrument of positive change, only discover that the structure is so systemically flawed that you despair of the possibility of healing coming from it, okay? That's true for people working with UN organizations and other humanitarian organizations in the city, people who are working in banking, in banking until 2008. You could fabricate confidence from in yourself. You could deal, and then you can deal with your clients and saying, I can project with quite a bit of confidence that your investment, if you'll trust me, will bear great fruit. After 2008, that becomes much more difficult, and you have to invent the confidence. And you can do that for a little while. And after a while, you realize you're going into the well inside you, and you're sucking up dust, you know. And so the church is a place where we can realize that we are loved, that our lives are holy, that people have a desire to do good. We are made more human when we do good, even if we are not immediately rewarded for that. It is a sanctuary. That is to say, it is a place where we can lay down our weapons, because all of us have weapons that enables us to survive in often adversarial situations. You can lay them down when you come in here, and you can pick them up later when you want to, but you can lay them down. And here, lower your defenses for an hour, and miracles happen. I don't know if that's coming.
I'm still interested in this concept of, let's say, feeding people who are hungry is a good thing to do. That's an assumption we're making.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come from? Does the Bible give us a clear indication of what's right and what's wrong, or is it too complicated to give us that?
Well, you know, as Gandhi said, the only way to proclaim good news to a hungry person is with bread. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something there. So you know that a good hunk of those same people are going to be hungry tomorrow. It is good because when we eat together, when we feed together, we are rendered healthier, but we're also rendered less isolated and alone. The problem that caused the hunger is often not diminished by this act of charity. But we are aware of the fact that it is always before us, and that's an important and good thing. So it is good, you know. I mean, when a disciple called Jesus a good teacher, and Jesus says, "Well, why do you call me good?" You know, that's the question you're asking.
That's what I'm asking you, John.
Why do you call it good? It is good because we all become more human when we participate in that.
That's a very good place to pause here. We've had some fascinating inputs from evidence-based science and critique of capitalism to the both the theoretical in a sense and the practical of religion and Christianity. I'm going to invite you to, as you've been very quiet and very well behaved so far, it must be said, have some time to talk. Now there are three people who are going to go in different places and form groups, and you're welcome to follow. Three, about the right number? Yeah, okay, let's do three. You're welcome to follow Arthur or David or David. Now, let's just stand. David Asprey, if you would stand so everyone sees who you are, will lead one of my groups. David Wood at the back will lead another, and Arthur, kind of central, will lead another. So if you all go to different tables up the stairs, then you can be very gentle with people and let them make their comments, and they will gather back to share that shortly.
How long?
About 30 minutes is what we usually say.